I'm really, really excited to have Sharon Foley with me today. She's the author of Getting to Yes, Clicker Training for Improved Horsemanship. And I just love that whole concept of getting to yes, because as you know, I love to train from a positive point of view. So I'm excited to have Sharon here, not only to share some experience that she's had with clicker training, but also she is doing something very unique because she's combining clicker training with natural horsemanship, with classical dressage, and I think that that is a really interesting combination. So welcome, Sharon. Are you there?
I am here, and I'm delighted to be here.
I am so thrilled that you've blocked off this time for me. So we're going to focus, actually, on how we can use clicker training in relation to helping people reduce their fears, fear of accident, fear of injury, fear of being out of control, all the normal kind of fears that people have with horses that buck or bolt or rear. But before we get started with that, I was just wondering, you know, there are a lot of myths about clicker training, and I wanted to ask you, for example, a lot of times people think, well, am I going to use clicker training to replace all of my aids?
Well, the answer to that would be, of course not. You know, dressage and riding is still dressage and riding. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about that that really needs to change. What clicker training is, and a lot of people misunderstand, is because they haven't studied it, the click of the clicker is not a cue. It's not to tell the horse to do something. It's to acknowledge the horse for already having done something. And so what I use clicker training for, and the principles of clicker training, because we could get into, you know, what I do and how I do it, but what I use it for is to build the building blocks, to put in place the building blocks that would develop the horse towards being lighter and softer to the aids that I already want him to be light and soft to.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
Go on. No, go on.
Well, I was going to say you're not using it to give an aid. You're using it basically to mark whatever behavior
you
want to reward.
Exactly. So I still would ride the same way. If anybody were to see me riding, they would say, I don't see any clicker training happening here. And that's because by the time you get to the point of actually riding, most of your obvious clicker training has already been done.
Yeah.
It's in the very beginning stages where you're working on the ground and developing the rapport and the relationship and how things are going to go between you and the horse. So, you know, I want that horse to be with me, to be looking at me, to be focusing on me, to be following me, and I start all that on the ground and being light and soft and mobile in their joints. And anytime I feel anything that I like, I mark that with the click and reward with whatever it is the horse is motivated to work for.
Yeah.
Some horses are motivated by food and other horses perhaps motivated by, you know, just scratching their favorite spot or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about breaking it down into the tiniest little chunks that you can possibly imagine, the smallest particle of feel, as Bill Dorrance, who's the author of True Horsemanship Through Feel, would say. So finding those tiniest particles and then sort of, I always think of it like as, you know, if that's like a little ember, the particle, that tiny little particle of softness that you want to have in the whole horse's body,
mm-hmm.
that tiny little particle, you kind of blow on it and blow on it.
Yeah, I love that.
Add some kindling and get it to fire up, you know. So you start with these tiny little thoughts and then you get yourself towards where you want to go. And that whole process of figuring out, well, what would be the smallest particle of what I want in the long term? What is the smallest particle? And that really is the hardest thing to wrap one's head around and then develop a plan that might involve clicker training and so forth.
Yeah, I love that image, that ember and blowing on the ember and adding the kindling. And you used an interesting word, and I think that this, maybe I was going to get into this after, but you used the word focus. And I think that that's great because my feeling is, for example, with a really spooky horse, and a lot of people have told me that they have issues with fear issues with their horse spooking and spinning really fast and whatever. And a horse that is afraid and looking out at their environment with their ears pricked forward, they're not focusing on you. They're focusing on the cougars and the predators that are out there. So it's so important that they do focus on you.
Absolutely. For me, the whole, and I don't know if this is something that you want me to spend a little bit of time talking about, but the whole natural horsemanship thing and how what I learned from all of that was that, I've been to a lot of show competitions and clinics and watching other people coming in with horses that are just so not okay. You know, inside their gut, they are not okay. And they're being asked to perform in this high-stress situation.
Right.
Adding to the fact that the rider is also stressed and making matters even worse, probably. But what I felt like I observed in seeing these horses coming in this condition was that they had missed a whole piece of the puzzle that, unfortunately, conventional modern dressage, because those people who believe, in classical dressage principles say, well, we don't need natural horsemanship because classical dressage principles include all of that. And I'm like, okay, great, teach it to me.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the reality is that most dressage training occurs after the horse is already under saddle, And so everybody, and I, of course, not everybody, but so many people don't have a handle on what should come before all of that.
The natural horsemanship brought to you, the equation
to me,
for you?
Exactly, because I realized that there was a whole other piece of the puzzle in terms of how that horse is feeling, inside, on any given moment, where is his attention, how relaxed is he, how okay is he with what is happening to him, but the things that I'm asking, his environment, and so forth. What I got out of studying the so-called natural horsemanship, and of course, there are so many definitions of what that means. My experience was with primarily with a guy named Harry Whitney, who is a wonderful, amazing horseman, just in terms of his understanding and his deep belief that he needs to get that horse okay, feeling good.
I love
feeling
that.
Good about being with me and being okay in his environment.
Yeah.
And that there's nothing more important than getting those thoughts off of the other stuff and here into this experience with me.
Mm-hmm.
And, I got into really studying what he was doing, and I felt that this was the prelude to what I really, theoretically what I really wanted to do was the dressage work, but the dressage is sort of the dancing and the gymnasticizing and all of that, but first we need to have a horse who's feeling pretty good about even starting that process with me, right?
Right,
so,
getting into that dialogue with you.
Getting into that dialogue. So that, to me, was the whole the horsemanship component of the whole thing was about that dialogue and beginning that dialogue and what is the first thing that needs to happen in order for that dialogue to begin. And that's what I was observing when I was watching these amazing horsemen who their main focus is not in dressage and competition and all of those things that many people want to do, which is fine, but he lives and breathes just making sure that the horse starts out okay. Whatever you want to do after that is certainly your choice, whatever you want to do after that, but getting that horse feeling really good. And number one is getting that horse with you, getting them focused and here and letting go of their thoughts of being worried, letting go of their thoughts of being elsewhere, and just, you know, being here and in the moment. And, of course, that sets the bar for us as human being to actually also be equally in the moment and in the here and in the now and be exactly so that we can support the horse in that process. And so that really gave me a lot of ideas about how the dots got connected. Like, what was the horse who's coming in with the wild rolling eyes and tense and uptight and it's just building to an explosion that there is no other end point except worst possible case scenario, which we're all afraid of. No one in their right mind is not at least a little bit concerned about that stuff, right?
No. We talked about that a little bit about, you know, that you're not a cowboy and you don't want to be riding the bucks out and that your solution is to feel, you know, safe.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, experience certainly gives one confidence. You know, if you've been working on your seat and developing your balance and so forth, that's really a, I mean, that's a huge part of everything. And, you know, going back to the whole myth thing, you know, a lot of people think, well, that's this whole clicker training business is some kind of shortcut that you don't have to learn how to ride. And that is just not true because what I learned from clicker training and what I learned from the horsemanship stuff is that every single thing I do counts. And so the way I sit, and so, you know, all of that matters. It absolutely matters. People, you know, need to know how to ride. And so the better rider you are and the more you work on your seat, the more confidence you have, certainly, when things happen, a little bit of a uh-oh, you know, ooh-like thing that the horse might do isn't going to unseat you. But I don't like the feeling that the horse is not feeling okay underneath me. The back is getting tighter, and the next thing you know, it feels like they're going to blow. And I'm like, whoa, don't like that feeling. I'm not enjoying that. The horse isn't enjoying that. And so we need strategies to try to redirect all of that, you know, before it turns into an explosion, because I'm not interested in rearing or riding out bucks. You know, I have, from time to time, people call me and say, well, I've got this two-year-old who's, you know, bucking in the canter, and can you take him for some training? And I'm like, no.
I hear you.
If you're interested in my solution involves, number one, start to wait till he's four, and two, spend the next 2 years preparing, you know, for making sure that that horse is feeling relaxed and confident and good, you know. And if you can focus on those things, then things like, you know, bolting off, you know, an explosive whatever, just, like, I'd like to think that it wouldn't happen. And,
wouldn't be an
issue.
Know,
so far, it works out pretty good, you know. From time to time, one misses buff. One misses. And so I look at that, if I, you know, if something happens that I didn't want to have happen, I have to look at myself and say, I missed something. What did I miss? What did I miss?
And I love how you said everything counts, because one of my little mantras that I live by is I'm going to change it, but what I normally say is every second you're on a horse, you're either training or untraining, but I'm going to change it based on what you just said, everything counts. Mm-hmm. Every second you're with a horse, you're either training or untraining, and you need to be aware of the things that you're doing that are either building that focus and building that confidence and building that relationship, or the things that are counterproductive for that.
Absolutely. And it's mind-boggling, really, when you start getting into just how many little things do count. And, you know, I spend a lot of my time working with relative novices who are trying to sort through problems that they're having, and, you know, I can see it happening before my eyes, And it's like, you need to, you know, like, let's say you're doing some groundwork, and very simple, just little leading the horse around you in a circle to the right and leading the horse around a circle to the left and so forth. And just what you're doing with your feet, it counts. The way you're holding the rope it counts. You know, because as soon as they change the way they're holding the rope, voila, everything changes.
Yeah.
As soon as they start to move their feet in a different way, voila, everything changes. Hmm. My goodness, there's so many little puzzle pieces that it can be, quite the learning experience to try to wrap your head around all that stuff.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that along those lines that everything counts, and every second you're with a horse, you're training or untraining. I just did a clinic last week, and one of the horses in the clinic gets a little nappy and sometimes just stops and grows roots to China and sometimes starts to back up a little bit. And this is the first time I had seen that rider. And what every time the horse did that behavior, what she did is she put her hands forward and put loops in the reins, thinking, okay, I'm going to open the door so my horse can go forward. And I said to her, you have to realize that your horse is doing this behavior and you're giving the reins. You're rewarding the horse for doing that behavior. So the horse is just going to be encouraged to do that more and more. You need to keep the reins and ask the horse to go forward through the rein, because if you're rewarding the behavior you don't want, that's what you're going to get more of. And I think it was a big revelation to her, but I think people don't realize the things that they're doing where they're inadvertently rewarding horses for behavior that they don't want.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of things in the environment that, you know, the horse doesn't know what counts and what doesn't count. And when you start talking about everything counting, you know, the horse doesn't know that this piece doesn't count. It only knows what...
I'm only kidding right now.
Right. That, you know, if the horse is feeling reinforced, and a lot of times people go, but I'm not rewarding him. It's like, it doesn't matter whether you think you're rewarding him or not. He is feeling reinforced for this behavior, whatever it is, whatever you're doing, the thing, if it's getting repeated, then there's something that is in the environment that is causing that horse to feel when he does X and you do Y, then Y happens. We don't even have to do Y on purpose, but just Y, you know, whatever it is, that thing is happening, and the horse is feeling, you know, and rewarded is such a weird word because, you know, you think of rewards as being like, you know, food and petting and so forth, and a lot of times, you know, the reward is just that release. And if the release, if you take your leg off as soon as anything bad happens, then the horse is like, ooh, well, I guess that's the thing I need to do more of, because that's when I feel the freest.
So it's not even so much reward as it's reinforcement. I mean, if you're giving positive reinforcement, you're adding something, like you're adding the clicker or you're adding food or you're adding. But if you are negatively reinforcing, which means you're taking something away, like you take your legs off or you soften the reins in the wrong moment or whatever, you're still reinforcing behavior, and then that's why they repeat that behavior. Yeah.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, I don't mean to be too personal here, but I think it was your first mare, is it Danka, that
actually
got you?
Tulsa is the mare that sort of put me on this road. Danka has taught me her own fair share. But
can you tell us about one or both of them and what they taught you?
Oh, sure. The whole thing got started really with Tulsa. Quite a few years ago, I had acquired this young mare, and I was having the usual problems that other people have. I couldn't get her to go right. She would like spin around and have a hissy fit. And she was, you know, 4.5. I bought her as a barely steering 4-year-old. And she's 20 now. She's 20 now. Yeah.
Cool.
And I still have her.
That's great.
She's still teaching me.
Yeah, of course.
In any case, I was very frustrated. I was a typical frustrated, I don't understand why this horse just doesn't do it. I would do a lot of crying.
Well, that helps a lot, didn't it?
Yeah, right. That sure did. I was just so frustrated, and I did not understand why she had to fight me on everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other horses that I rode didn't behave like that. Mm-hmm. And I just was very frustrated by the whole thing. And So that was sort of the backdrop to some other things taking place, which were seemingly unrelated, but it's as the universe shifts mysteriously, mm-hmm. they were obviously related ultimately. Mm-hmm. And a dear friend of mine had just gotten a puppy and had learned about clicker training via this, an internet email group having to do with the dog. And so she ordered a couple of clickers and little booklets on training with clicker training, and she gave one to me and a couple of other friends. And as soon as I read the little booklet, I'm like, wow, this is just really cool stuff.
Yeah.
And I spent the next year playing with my dog. It never occurred to me that this had anything to do with horses. You know, it was completely all about the dog. And I had fun learning how to shape behavior. And, you know, I was just studying the whole concept and learning about operant conditioning and the whole idea behind clicker training. And I was a member of various, you know, clicker training lists online. And the people who were online talking about clicker training and their dogs mostly, I was just completely floored and fascinated with how creative these people were. It was just mind-blowing, and I wanted to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, back at the farm, I have this mare that's spinning around, and I'm crying, and I don't understand what's going wrong. As I said, it was sort of unrelated to the clicker training because I didn't even really know clicker training had existed and that it would involve the horse. I had read an article, and my friend and I, my horsey friend who did every horsey thing together, we decided after reading this article about how to train Spanish walk that we wanted to train the horses to do this Spanish walk thing. And I didn't know about clicker training at the time. So it was all about molding by lifting the leg up onto some kind of block and then rewarding with food when the leg was on there. I got it on cue and managed to get her lifting and walking to tap with the whip, and I did all this without clicker training because I didn't even know it existed. And it was all very interesting, and I learned a lot about the process, you know, the learning process and so forth. But, again, I didn't really connect what would a future clicker training business. Then, as I said, you know, I had been playing with the dog for a long time, and I was learning more about reinforcement and that when behavior is being repeated, then something is reinforcing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after a while, my friend and I, you know, when things would happen, we'd go, what's reinforcing that behavior?
Good question.
And we just started thinking about it. Yeah. And one day, and this is sort of my turning point moment, so this is it, and I may become verklempt just thinking back on it, but the turning point moment was I was just riding my horse, doing whatever I was doing that day, and I wasn't thinking about things like Spanish walk. I was just thinking about, I don't know, launches in or something. I don't know what I was playing with at the time. And then out of the blue, my horse just, Tulsa, offered the Spanish walk.
Oh, my gosh.
Out of the blue.
Gave me goosebumps.
I know. My goodness. Me too. out of the blue. And all of a sudden, you know, because it hit me, all of a sudden, I realized that she offered that behavior because it had been rewarded, and she really had no idea what else I wanted. And so she offered the thing that seemed a likely prospect.
It was like she was soliciting a reward.
She was soliciting a reward because she didn't know what else I wanted.
Yeah.
And I realized at that moment that all of my frustrations were her saying to me, I have no clue.
Yeah.
What you want, why you want it, what you're asking me to do. I can't do it. I don't know why you're asking me to do these things. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks at that moment that if she knew what I wanted and she believed she could do it, well, she'd be doing it.
Yeah.
And if she's not doing it, then there's like a reason. There's a reason why. And so then it became my job to try to break it down and to try to figure it out. And eventually I did get her to go right without a
disagreement. Yeah.
I did. Finally, after, you know, all these years, I can claim that much. but it was a very defining very defining moment that I just got whacked upside the head with how obvious it was now that if she and the cool thing for me is that I stopped crying because I felt much more like, okay, it's a problem, I can break it down and I'll solve the problem.
Yeah.
As a, you know, as opposed to feeling helpless.
Yeah, overwhelmed.
And I think for
you're at the end of your rope. You there's
you
nothing.
Don't
you
don't have
know what
any
to do.
Better ideas.
Yeah.
You know? And so when you don't have any better ideas, you get mad, you get frustrated, and that's when things just devolve and never get any better. They're not going to get any better like that. So what the whole process and the experience gave me was a more, you know, a larger toolkit of saying, I have options. There's, it's never over till it's over. You know, we can break this down and break this down and break it down and to the smallest possible piece until we can get ourselves onto a track that's going in the direction that we want to go. And it's just a matter of putting one foot in front of the other one, but it's about being able to roll back. How far can you roll back? And can you identify the smallest possible piece of the puzzle? And I think most people are jumping in the deep end and not really getting, what can I do outside the pool that actually would be contributing to success rather than diving into the deep end of the pool and drowning, you know?
Yeah, and
metaphorically speaking.
So when you talk about breaking things down to the smallest step and the smallest step, that brings me to the you were telling me about training your horse that had a canter issue.
Right, right.
Can,
oh yeah, that's
can you share that?
I
that was
delighted.
Really breaking things down to small steps.
Very, very small steps. Yeah. My other horse that I is now in my life is Donka, and she actually came to me as a client's horse. And Donka is 17.2, and the client was 5.1 and 100, you know, 100 pounds wet. Kind of overfaced in terms of horse. And she is such a sensitive mare, chestnut, thoroughbred, hand-varying cross. So very big ideas. She thought she knew how it was going to go. And unfortunately, things had already devolved a little bit out of control with the previous, you know, with the previous owner. Mm. And when I got into the picture, the other thing that had happened already that I was aware of was that Donka had already bucked off the owner in a big way.
Oh, dear.
And also the previous owners had already also been hurt by this horse.
Huh.
So I'm like not interested in getting hurt. The good news was that the horse already was clicker savvy by the time she came to me because she had had an injury and had to be on, you know, it was like a suspensory thing. So she was on stall rest for many months. And so my client, who the previous owner, had done quite a bit of clicker training with the horse just to play with her, to give her something to do and keep her relaxed and you know, doing something that just isn't standing around the stall getting frantic. So she taught her various tricks, like she can pick up objects and put them in the trash bin and, you know, picked up a
my house.
Yeah, exactly. she can smile, you know, she does like a little lip thing and
yeah.
she bows and picks up your whip and hands it to you and just little fun things. So the horse was already what I call clicker savvy. So she got the process of being shaped and what the click meant.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously that was really good for me because I didn't have to go through all of that part. That was already done.
Yeah.
The horse came to me clicker savvy. And what I had discovered when I started riding her a little bit was that if you even thought about cantering, you hadn't actually cantered or even put your leg on or even done anything. You just thought about it. She would just become very stiff and start careening at this huge trot to the left. It was just horrible and completely unpleasant. Now, other people would say, why don't you just, can't you just make her do it? And I'm like, I'm not going to be the one that gets bucked off. Thank you very much. So, no, I'm not going to just try to make her do it. I'm not going to whack her to make her do it. And I can't, you know, and the stronger you use your leg to try to, you know, force her into it, she would just get more panicky and more careeny, and it would just be bad. It was not pleasant, and I wasn't interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I had already observed that she was pretty pretty savvy to a kiss sound on the lunge line to pick up the canter. Now, I knew she could canter.
Kiss
sound her
like,
canter.
Like that? You
yeah,
mean?
Little, yeah, just yeah. like a little kissing noise.
Yeah.
And that was her cue. Her was her verbal cue to canter. So, like, sometimes people say canter, and this, somehow
mm-hmm.
she had learned, somebody had taught her to kiss, and kiss
mm-hmm.
meant canter. So I'm like, all right, well, I can use that. So what I did was I just focused on getting her aligned, you know, with the shoulders in front of the hips,
mm-hmm.
and not any concern about whether she was in front of my leg or bending in any kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I used no leg. I think I borrowed this from somebody else, but I don't know who to give credit to. I forget. And this is kind of a creepy little analogy, but I call it your paraplegic seat,
yeah.
where only the upper body has any control. So everything was done with my upper body,
yeah.
waist down, nothing, just
yeah.
completely nothing. And I used the reins and my upper body to just align her shoulders in front of her hips.
Mm-hmm.
And I clicked and treated a lot for just that aligning. So I would lift the rein and
mm-hmm.
bring her head, neck, shoulders in front of the hips, click. Stop, give her, you know, her sugar, and repeat, 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 so that I didn't have to work very hard in getting the alignment going. And then I would just sort of maintain my upper body position but do nothing with my leg and just kiss.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that she knew how to canter from the kiss. And as soon as I felt her even think about the possibility of maybe trying to canter, so she hadn't actually taken a step yet, I just felt her shift her weight in such a way that she was going to prepare to canter,
mm-hmm.
I clicked.
Mm.
So that
really
was the
baby
moment.
Steps, yeah.
Beyond baby steps. No one
yeah.
would, you know, you wouldn't normally think of that, but just the thought that she would canter, that's what I was clicking.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't clicking any body movement per se. It was her change of thought, that
mm-hmm.
her thought was now on cantering, and I clicked that. And I, you know, what I want a horse to do when I click is stop.
Yeah.
Immediately, and look at me, and where's the food, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I give her sugar, and I did the setup again. I aligned her shoulders in front of her hips so she was nice and straight, and then kissed. No leg, no seat, no
mm-hmm.
nothing, just kissed. As soon as she mobilized again to pick up the canter without picking it up, clicked, and I repeated this. And then I started to let one stride leak out, and then I would click.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would let another couple of strides leak out, and then I would click. And again, every time you stop, you feed the retreat,
mm-hmm.
set it up again so that I had her nice and aligned, and then I would repeat, 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 you know, day after day. So each day I would start with thinking about canter, then one or two steps, then halfway around in a circle, and then the next day the same process over and over again. And each, little by little, I always seem to have to go back to square one every day.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go back to thinking about the canter and just being aligned.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but usually over time, even if I had to start with one step, I could go a little further. Like I'd go a little longer. So all the way around the circle and then
mm-hmm.
I would click. So I would click before it got bad. That was the important part.
Mm-hmm.
And so this went on for literally days and weeks and months
mm.
and creeping forward with the number of steps that I could take before it fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, months went by, and people were, like, looking at me going, can't you canter that horse yet? And I'm like, no, not yet, because they just saw me, like, feeding a lot of food. They didn't
yeah,
see
really.
Me doing much cantering. And, now, meanwhile, I should mention that I was clicking for a lot of things. You know, I would click her because she wasn't that she was opposed to putting my – she wasn't opposed to my leg being on her at all. It was just the setup for the canter that kind of got her worried.
Mm.
So I would do lots of trotting from on the right side and on the left side and responding to my leg aids to go forward just in the trot, responding to my aids to slow down and to stop, to turn and to do all these things and relax and stretch. And if
and
I
you were clicking for all those behaviors.
I would click for all of those behaviors all along anyway.
And that makes the horse safer, any horse safer.
Absolutely, because they're feeling good. You're clicking them for relax, you know.
Yeah.
That's what you want, you know.
Yep.
So eventually, the cool thing about the whole process with Donka was that it was many months in the making, and then all of a sudden, sort of, all of a sudden, one day, it was just done. And then I could canter for 10 minutes. You know, it just, once it was done, it was done. But that whole process, that's where, you know, a lot of people came to me and like, I don't know if I could have had the patience for all of that. And it's like, I'm like, you can either get bucked off or you have the patience for that.
I chose. You always have a choice. And I'm with you. I am so non-confrontational. And I think patience and persistence always is the best way to go. And that's a huge testament what you did with her over that period
absolutely.
Of time.
Right. Absolutely. And then, you know, after that, people are going, what horse is that? I'm like, well, this is just the same horse. They're like, oh, my God, I don't even recognize her. She just transformed. She used to make the most horrible faces. She would kick other horses while you were riding. I mean, literally stop dead, back up, and start to wail on them. And I, like, you know, had to make sure there weren't any children nearby while I was riding.
Oh, my God.
It was, she was quite a challenge. She was quite a challenge. But in the end, the owner sold her to me for a dollar.
For what?
She saw that for a dollar.
For a dollar.
Yeah. Because she saw that no one else was really going to take that kind of time with such a,
to build,
you know,
that relationship.
Particular kind of mare. And she knew that the horse was too much for her, and she really needed a horse who was a lot more already okay.
Yeah.
And so I ended up, I still have Donka, and she's lovely.
Yeah.
No regrets.
Did you go to the USDF convention that Kira Kirkland did by any chance?
I did not, no.
Somebody asked her there, when I think about Donka, someone asked her if she preferred riding geldings or stallions or mares, and in her inimitable style, she said, well, a gelding, you can tell.
Yeah.
A stallion, you have to ask, and
a mare, you negotiate?
No, well, close. A mare, you have to fill out an application.
There you go.
That's what your horse sounded like. So it takes a very special person with a great technique and the desire to build that relationship and the patience and persistence. And I think that's awesome that you use the clicker training. But let me ask you why, for example, it wouldn't have been enough, let's say you were just doing the setup, just to say, good girl. Why is that not enough to just use a verbal reward?
Well, in my view, first of all, you know, good girl, good boy, these are conditioned reinforcers, just like a click is. But I kind of call it the halo effect.
The halo effect?
Yeah. To say good girl, it's sort of this generalized, pleasurable, hopefully pleasurable thing. Mm-hmm. If, you know, presumably good girl has been associated with rest and maybe a scritchy or whatever, but it, to me, I call it the sort of like halo effect, because it just gives you a little warm glow, but it's not really like a laser beam of warm, you know, hot, fiery glow.
Yeah.
So the good girl is warm glow. You know, the click of the clicker is so sharp and so clear and so specific that it's how you break things down. It doesn't make any sense to use a clicker or any kind of, you know, one thing you haven't asked is, do I actually use a clicker? And the answer to that is no. I actually use a tongue click. So I just make a little sharp noise. It's like as if I were snapping my fingers. It's just a little sound.
Yeah.
So you don't actually have to have a clicker, but you want to have some kind of sharp, quick, you know, marking signal, because good girl could go along with which part of this equation. We don't know.
Yeah.
But clicker training, you know, the whole idea is to shape tiny little particles of behavior up till you get what you want, kind of like what I had done with the whole canter thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start with a thought and you work on that and you massage it and blow on it until you've got what you want.
Mm.
I think a lot of times people don't really buy in to the process, because truthfully it's the process that is the most important part of it. So to simply say, well, I'm going to click the horse for something,
mm-hmm.
Is almost like not enough. You might as well just say good girl,
mm-hmm.
because it's not sharp enough. And the only reason to have that sharp of a marker is if you're working on the particle level. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You have to be, the whole point is to work on the particle level and to be observing and feeling of those tiny little particles as they grow and grow. And so the clicker itself is almost not the really magical part. The magical part is the working on the particle level. Develop, like at the molecular level, to say you're starting with the atom and you're building up until
mm-hmm.
you have a thing, you know.
Cool. You're very artistic in your little images.
Well, thank you. I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Yeah.
I'm saying the point, the whole concept of clicker training is so much about it's what's happening at the particle level, which is
right.
Why when people ask things like, you know, what about the AIDS? Like, the AIDS are so far down the road,
right,
beyond the particle level. You know what
yeah.
I mean? The clicker training part comes in when you're talking about a thought,
yeah.
when you're talking about how to redirect a thought. And if you can get the horse to redirect at the thought level, you know, you don't really, you know, you've got a very powerful, a strategy for avoiding worst case possible case
right.
scenarios, because the thing that is the worst case possible case scenario, the bolt or the rear or the buck, the thing that happens before the thing that happens is
mm-hmm.
the thing that we need to be focusing on and redirecting before that all happens. And so
yeah.
clicker training is about what comes before and
right.
and developing a plan at the molecular level, at the particle level, and saying, I want to have a whole new way of being with my horse,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to setting things up for failure, where there's no chance that if you're already getting in the buck,
yeah,
kind of too late.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of need to resolve it a lot sooner. And that, you know, makes me think about this whole paradigm shift, which is very important to me to share with people, because the whole notion that we're working at the particle level
mm-hmm.
and that you believe that if the horse knew what you wanted and the horse believed they could do it, they'd be doing it. So you have to change your mind and start looking at what you want sooner rather than later, and directing the horse towards what you want, and without really getting into dealing with the after the fact. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
It's like,
yeah.
it's like the whole mindset has to be focused on what you want and how small a piece can you break
mm-hmm.
it down into to ensure, to guarantee that you're successful, because you want to set yourself and the horse up for success. You don't want to set them up for failure and then have no choice except to whack them upside the head
yeah.
because they did the wrong thing. We need to have a whole another angle, another way of looking at it. And, you know, that's what clicker training brought me to, was that whole mindset change that I'm
yeah.
looking. You've got to look at the side of the coin that is the thing you want. And that my observation when I watch really amazing trainers like, you know, the Harry Whitneys of the world who don't use clicker training, but I watched them and I noticed that they're working at the particle level and they are so focused on setting that horse up for success that, you know, that is just what really great horsemen do. And then it made me start to realize that I've read in the classical texts, you know, ask often, expect little, reward generously. What does that mean? And I think now I understand what that means.
Yeah.
And I came to that understanding by observing really great horsemen and what they do and how they do it and why they make the choices that they make and how small can the particle be.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the word particle from Bill Dorrance. I didn't make that one up. Bill Dorrance wrote True Horsemanship Through Feel, which is like, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest book on horsemanship ever written, ever.
Wow.
And everybody, I think everybody should read it. And he speaks of a particle of feel.
Mm.
A particle of feel. And that is that moment where the horse gives you their thought.
Mm.
And you feel the softness just sort of trickle through the whole body. You know, and where does that start? It starts with a particle of feel. Just that moment that the horse chooses to think about the possibility of lifting that foot or shifting the weight.
Right.
And then what I just said was, hey, if I can, and another thing that Bill Doran said that I love is, he says other fellas, and he always uses the word fellas.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way he speaks. You have to read the book to really appreciate it. He'll say things like, you know, other fellas, they'll say, make the right thing easy and the wrong thing difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says that, well,
like
that may work
that
for them.
Up for success. Yeah.
And he says that might work for them, but I say, and Bill Dorrance is said to have said, he says, why not just make the right thing obvious?
Ah.
I love that. And
yeah.
So, now I'm thinking, oh, I know all this stuff about clicker training and positive reinforcement, and if I can make the right thing, like, even more obvious, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah.
Which is how I sort of started taking the horsemanship and the traditional horsemanship, you know, and I can do all that stuff, you know, and I can work with the rope, and I can work with energy, and I can work with all kinds of modes of reinforcement. But if I can help a horse and make the right thing even more obvious without having to get bigger, because a lot of times you watch these really fine horsemen, they're pretty big guys oftentimes, you know, and they're not, you know, they're pretty okay with letting the horse get pretty big in order to make a change and get the change that they want so that then the horse can be okay about it. He'll say, you know, they'll say, why make him wonder about where he needs to be for any longer than he needs to be? And I buy that.
Mm.
But a lot of times these guys, you know, they'll use a lot of energy and they'll get really big and then the horse has to get huge and has to leave and it gets all very dramatic.
Mm.
And a lot of times, you know, maybe I don't really want to go there, you know, with that. If I could come in another door and say, why do I need to get that big? If I could, say, draw the horse in with, say, through a different door. And I've had, you know, experiences. An example is this mare that I worked with last summer who came in for training. And, you know, where I'm based is a natural care facility. So all the horses are out living 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
And the group that she was in has a gelding who is like, you know, the king. And this mare came in and she just wailed on him and he wailed on her and she wailed on him and she was like, you think you can wail on me and I'm going to back off? You're insane. No. And I'm watching this transpire and I'm like, how could I possibly do more than what the horses have already done and get her attention? And it wasn't getting her attention. And so, you know, I would take her into the round pen and I'm like trying to, you know, because I always will sort of test the waters and see how horses react to just energy and so forth. And she was so gone, mentally gone. She was out of that, she was long out of that round pen. and no amount of jumping up and down, making a fit, was going to change her. And I'm like, oh, the horse is going to change her. What could I possibly do that would change her? So I started clicker training her. And it was all, it was like she went, oh, are you talking to me? So then, never mind. And so in very short order, she completely transformed from a horse who was completely gone, and no amount of force was going to make her change her mind. Certainly none that I was willing to engage in. And I'm a sturdy girl. not that much of a wilting flower. But she completely transformed, and she became a completely lovely little safe mare, and riding her bareback in a halter.
You gave me goosebumps again.
Fairly short period of time. So it's all about just getting that mindset change in the horse.
Yeah.
Come on in. The water's fine, you know?
Yeah, getting to yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Sharon, I mean, I could talk to you forever. This is so awesome, and I would love to be able to tell you a million stories. But can you give a website or something if people want to see what you're doing and contact you or whatever? Can
Absolutely.
You give some information?
Sure. The website address is www.horsemansarts.com. And you have to make sure you spell it Horseman's Arts. So
Horsemansarts.com. Okay, cool.
That's my website. And I have a website and a blog and so forth there that I'm trying to keep up with. I'm so impressed with what you do in terms of developing content on a continuous basis. I know how challenging that is, and that's very impressive that you continue to work so hard to do that for people.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for sharing all those experiences. I know that people are going to really benefit from that
and maybe
have their own paradigm shift.
I'd love that. I'd love that.
Okay. Thanks again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.